live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. This is an Empowerment Hour. No guest today. But I will share the latest on health and healing and what's good for prostate cancer, brand new treatment. Also, an interesting article from the Saturday Evening Post. And it's entitled, The $14 Billion Question, Are Cholesterol Meds Worthless? And that's in the current issue. And that's an investigation by the Saturday Evening Post. And I'll give you their opinion, then share mine. From our environmental section today, from David Suzuki, environmentalism has failed. Biocentric view is needed, from his website. So we will read that. And then also from our environmental section, our country is being fracked by the merger of government and big business, from Washington's blog. So I'll share that as well. But most of today's program is going to be taken up with the issues that you find important. This is your opportunity to deal with any issue, any question, any thoughts, any challenges. There is no censorship on this program. We invite people to share their points of view. As long as we can learn something from it, we all benefit. So our number is 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. We'll be joined with your questions from Luann Panessi in about 15 minutes. I won't be taking calls before then, but after that time I will. Let's begin. There's something from the University of Chicago Medical Center that they have found that is interesting and something really original. Beehive extract shows potential as prostate cancer treatment. Let me quote this. An over-the-counter natural remedy derived from honeybee hives arrests the growth of prostate cancer cells and tumors in mice, according to this new research paper from the University of Chicago Medicine. Caffeic acid, which is a phenethyl ester, or what's called CAPE, C-A-P-E, it's a compound isolated from the honeybee hives, bee propolis, and the resin that's used by bees to patch up holes in the hive. Propolis has been used for centuries as a natural remedy for conditions ranging from sore throats and allergies to burns and cancer. But the compound has never gained acceptance in the clinic due to scientific questions about its effect on cells. In a paper published in Cancer Prevention Research, a major peer-reviewed journal, researchers combined traditional cancer research methods with cutting-edge proteomics to find that this particular substance from bee propolis arrests early-stage prostate cancer by shutting down the tumor cell system of detecting sources of nutrition. Quote, if you feed CAPE to mice daily, their tumors will stop growing. After several weeks, if you stop the treatment, the tumors will begin to grow again at the original pace. That's according to Dr. Richard Jones, assistant professor in the Ben May Department of Cancer Research and Institute of Genomics and Systems Biology. So it doesn't kill the cancer, but it basically will indefinitely stop prostate cancer proliferation. Now, why is this important? Because how many times have you heard people call up on this radio program and say, Gary, I'm 55 years old and I was fine, I was healthy, and then started this excessive urination and burning when I urinated, and I started having a little lower back pain about the mid of my back, and I couldn't figure it out, went to the doctor, and finally I got a diagnosis, and first they said my PSA was high, and then they said, oh, you got an enlarged prostate, or maybe prostate cancer. I would have then talked about the prostate, and I would have talked about the prostate in ways that most people have not heard. First, I would describe it as about the size of a walnut, and it's at the base of the bladder that encircles the urethra. Now, we all know that the urethra is where urine comes out of the body, and the prostate's primary job is to produce prostatic fluid, which makes up the bulk of male ejaculate and nourishes and transports the sperm. In effect, it's the energy of life, and the primary energy that creates life. Now, just on a biochemical level, it contains all this, but I would look at it differently. I would also say that beyond the biochemical, when you have something that you're able to create life with, after all, if you exchange saliva, that doesn't create life. Stares, shaking hands, hugging, doesn't create life. The sperm does. That means it has an essential energy. So that essential energy should be analyzed on more than just what's in it. How many sperm are in it? Are they deformed? What rate they're traveling? And realize that this is one of the highest vibrational issues. If you measured blood, saliva, urine, sweat, and tears, and sperm has the highest vibrational level. Now that tells you a lot. It also tells you a lot if you're practicing Tantra, if you're practicing the Kundalini, or you're controlling the ejaculate, either releasing it or not, and what that does to the rest of the body's energy and your first chakra. But I won't get into that because that's a separate issue, and it's a little more esoteric. But we do know that that's the reason you have a prostate. And without that prostate, then you're not going to be able to have the prostatic fluid. Then we end up with an enlarged prostate, but before you get an enlarged prostate, you have an inflamed prostate. And the inflammation from things that we don't consider at all. Hot dogs, hamburgers, french fries, pizza, beer, alcohol, caffeine. We don't think of those as being inflammatory agents, but they are. They're highly acidic. And in a highly acid medium, the prostate is extremely vulnerable, as are the breast and the uterus. Now, once you have inflammation, it depends upon how much inflammation you have and what are the sources. For example, an X-ray produces a phenomenal amount of inflammation because it produces hydroxyl free radicals. It's the difference between getting a little smack on the face and someone hitting you in the jaw with a sledgehammer. The implications for the body are staggering. And even those people who can have a tumor shrink, which is not that difficult, with radiation, don't take into consideration that the shrinkage of the tumor, if it comes back, shouldn't be a therapy of choice. And frequently that's what happens. And you almost never hear about the high percentage of people who've received a lot of radiation getting secondary cancers because of the radiation of the treatment. And that's one of the reasons in a major paper that has just been finished and is out being reviewed for publication as we speak, we've sent it to some independent reviewers and then I'll submit it to some journals, where using only their literature and only their statistics, I literally challenge the entire cancer establishment to stop for a moment and take an honest look at what they're doing in the name of proven therapy. Well, there's nothing proven in what they're doing. And it's all experimental, with only about 12% results that are favorable, which means you've got 88% that's not. And no one ever talks about the 550,000 people who will be toe-tagged and buried this year using only orthodox therapy. Now, you start multiplying that times 20 years, and you're up between 7 and 10 million Americans have died. And yet no one questions what they're doing. That maybe all these research grants from the National Institutes of Health and the National Cancer Society, and who gets the money? And what happens when you fail? You get more money. It's one of these unique phenomena that people refuse to examine. Do we ever look at medical bureaucracies or governmental bureaucracies? The people inside are masters of controlling where the money goes, but never give you the results, but only give you promises. Keep funding us, and someday we'll come up with a miracle. It's highly political, and it forces people to come out and say, sure, we'll write you a check, because they're afraid if they're the person who says, no, I'm not going to continue this. Ah, then you don't want Americans to be cured of cancer. Ah, you want women to get breast cancer. They have the Bill O'Reilly phenomena. The moment you don't support the American troops, then you're for the enemy. Nothing could be further from the truth. I don't support our wars. I'm anti-war. And I will not back off that. but I am for our troops, as anyone who's seen my documentaries, including the latest one, and all the work I've done for the vets, and continue to do. So you can be against war and for the veterans who frequently are in wars because it's the only place they can make a living. Now, back to this whole idea. So here we have this prostate gland. And we're going to have about 220 to 250,000 new cases of prostate cancer this year. Around 30,000 men in America will die. Why? First, because almost all of the way we treat prostate is by measuring prostatic specific antigen, or PSA. That has been called into question as the ultimate tumor marker. It is not. And so when the moment people start having a 1 or a 2 or 3 or 4, then they want to start putting you on therapy. Between 4 and 10, then they're suggesting they got to put you on a more aggressive therapy. And if you're above 50, it indicates a tumor that has spread elsewhere in the body. Then implanted radiation pellets, radiation, chemotherapy. But they don't have a big success rate. And once again, you can't look at any problem by being selective in the information that you bring in to make your point and intentionally denying anything that legitimately challenges it. And that's what we do in almost all of our institutions today. We cherry-pick information. And so then when these contradictions pop up, they have no way of talking to us except to condescend or to patronize. And since the average person is not a cancer doctor or an oncologist, they can't talk in the terminology, and then they back off. And as a result, nothing changes. So I would tell you, okay, first and foremost, if you have any bleeding or urinary retention or impotency or sepsis, which is blood poisoning, you might then have a problem with your prostate. So turn off all of the pro-inflammatory agents, all the sodas, the fructose, the artificial sweeteners. Go strictly to an alkaline cleansing and detox program. Cleanse and purify the blood. We know how to do that. We know which herbs and botanicals and which zeolites in the homeopathic field are good blood purifiers. But these are the first stage. Then you look at the foods and the cruciferous vegetables. You're taking your cruciferous vegetables every day, once or even twice a day, would be one of the single best things you could do to prevent cancer, all cancers, and if you have cancer, to fortify the body with known and proven anti-cancer agents. Then so cruciferous vegetables, you bet, every day, absolutely, for everybody. Then you look at the nutrients that are known to help the prostate. At the top of my list would be coenzyme A, which works with coenzyme Q10 and detoxifying. Then I would look at dimethylglycine, DMG, hyperoxygenates the blood, garlic, maybe 4 times a day, which helps to break down testosterone and has been able to slow cancer growth. Proteolytic enzymes with every meal. Superoxide dismutase, but getting that, to get it right, you have to really get it in injection from a physician. And then lycopene and vitamin E and B complex and vitamin C in intravenous dosage. And vitamin D3 and maitake mushrooms at 48,000, 9,000, and the berry complexes. Really important because we know that berries have phytonutrients that help regulate cell function and have suppression of cancer as one of the primary. So raspberries, strawberries, blueberries, pomegranates, all your berries. Then glutathione in reduced form. That's great, along with L-cysteine and methionine, which are sulfur-containing amino acids that detoxify and protect the liver. And then L-carnitine, which protects against free radical damage and toxins. And then, of course, you can use taurine, which functions to help repair the prostate, zinc, black radish, dandelion, milk thistle, red clover, all-important Buccia, B-U-C-H-U, Carnivore, Echinacea, Paldiarco, Summa, all have anti-cancer pro-benefits, mainly in a tincture or NT form. Damiana, good. Gravel root, hydrangea, oat straw, parsley, yuba ursi, yarrow. These are all important. Green tea, absolutely, because green tea has been shown at the Mayo Clinic to be a very powerful killer of prostate cancer cells. Modified citrus pectin, yes, it inhibits growth of cancer cells. And pygium in saw palmetto, also important, and as is resveratrol, which is from grapes and grape juice, and turmeric at a very high level with its active ingredient curcumin, generally 7 to 10,000 milligrams at that point, and lots of citrus. So that's what I would be offering, and so that's why anything that's new that we can add to that is just one more piece to that puzzle. And up they come with caffeic acid, the phenylethyl ester, or what's called CAPE. Now, if you were to ask me what is one of the best ways of protecting your immune system if you have a cold or flu, I would suggest bee propolis in liquid form, used with other nutrients. And generally, it's a black resin, very sticky. You want to make sure you get it down your throat, otherwise it'll stain your teeth. It's almost like drinking tar. Not the most pleasant thing, but it does a terrific job. But for all these years, every beekeeper, and I'm a beekeeper, I have 40 beehives, every beekeeper I know knows you leave the bee propolis because that also is what protects the bees. And historically, and starting with my great-aunt Myrtle, I used to be with her when she would go out, and she would rarely take honey. She said, let the bees have their food. It keeps them strong. And then in turn, they pollinate all these berries and these trees, the nut trees. And she was right. And she said, I take a little bit of propolis, but just a small amount, and then I make it up into a paste. And then I add these other ingredients, and I don't know what else she added. But I saw this jar of stuff, and I remember once, or at least when I was growing up, I don't know about you, when you start to get a sore throat or a chest cold, your mom would come in and put some warm Vaseline, methylated Vaseline on your chest, and you could smell it, and it would be really warm, and it actually worked. But my Aunt Myrtle would also make you drink this foul, I mean terrible tasting concoction, but you get up the next day and be terrific. A real herbalist who lived close to nature. So they didn't have the science, but they had the insight. Now we have the science to use. So that's good news. Now also, I've been asked many times, when a person is doing laying on of hands, or a person is a sensitive, my mother was a sensitive, the only one in our extended family, going back to her grandmother, but everyone else wasn't, and I had that gift. What do you see? I never tell anyone ever what I see. Because then once they know you can tell them something, they never stop asking, well, should I do this? What do you see if I do that? And free will is the most important issue in life. You take away someone's free will, and then what have you got? And you have no idea how quickly people will cross that boundary of respecting you by not asking you constant questions. And so if you are sensitive, just use your gift without telling people. And you can use it in very clever ways. One of the ways I do is, even with my own family growing up, is I would make suggestions to them with a hope that they would follow it. They never did. No one in my family ever did anything I asked them to do, ever, not once. But there's a consequence to life when we make bad choices. But there's a good consequence when we make good choices. And there's always a point where we reach a fork in the road. Do I continue doing what I'm doing with the same attitude and the same beliefs and the same values? Then what is the likely outcome? Even though I may not know when that outcome will come, Today, next week, 5 years, 10 years from now, it's going to come. It's there waiting for you. Or do I take the other path and do I try to do everything that honors my life and others? There'll be a different outcome. And sometimes you'll hear people say that they see auras. And, of course, immediately the medical establishment, scientific establishment says, well, that's quackery. There is no such thing. You can't see it. What most people don't know is that for 30 years, while I was doing cutting-edge anti-aging research, calorie restriction research at the Institute of Applied Biology, that full 30 years I was doing psi research or energy research, over 140 different experiments, major experiments. When there was a best-selling book on pyramid power, I duplicated all those pyramids in miniature, and every single test I did failed. So I had to question how legitimate were the claims they were making. And then I found out they weren't. That doesn't mean that there wasn't something that could happen, but not based upon the claims they were making. And then when I finally had a chance once, when I was in Arizona, and I had finished a major lecture, I ran into the author of one of these popular selling books. And it was at a social event, and I simply walked over and I asked this person, I said, could you please answer a question for me? The person said, sure. I said, do you have any solid proof for all the claims that are in your book? He said, yeah. I said, could you share those with me? Because when I looked in the book, I didn't see actual references that corresponded to any proof other than someone telling you something. And where that may or may not have been true, and I'm certainly not discounting what someone says, I want to see if it can be duplicated. Because one of the basis of science is that something happens and doesn't just happen to one single person. It'd be like saying, I help one person overcome the cold with this protocol, so therefore it would benefit everyone. Not necessarily. But what if you helped 100 or 1,000 people, and what if others took your protocol and they in turn helped thousands of people, and then they in turn helped people? Then you have something you can fairly well say. It's not just an isolated example. There was a whole lot of background, and our basic rule in the lab was you had to do an experiment 6 times. For example, when I wanted to see about psi healing, and why did I do this at all? It was very simple. Because I saw what happened when my mother put her hands on people's heads growing up. I was watching upstairs. I'd sneak down and look through the banister. And every evening, 7 nights a week, my mom from about 7 o'clock after dinner till about 10 o'clock, people would come quietly. She never charged anyone. She said, never charge for this gift or you won't have it. But she would do this. She wouldn't tell a person a thing. She'd just smile, or she would hold their hands. And it was only at my mother's funeral that I couldn't believe how many people came to the funeral. It was probably, if not the largest funeral in our town's history, certainly one of them. And what happened was so many people came over and were talking about the stories of Blandina. That was my mother's name. The healings that happened after she was with them, even though she never said a word. And it was this energy. So that puzzled me. So I just wanted to see, was there a way that other people had this? I'm sure there were. But how would we know? So I put the word out that I was going to do a research project. And for this project, I needed people who believed that they could help people with cancer. For whatever way. And I was inundated. In fact, it took me over a year of screening people to find 50 people who I believed had enough evidence from people giving them letters, and I'd read the letters, to even put them in this experiment. But then I wasn't using people. I wanted something that wouldn't be influenced by charisma or theater or placebo. Specially bred rats that I was borrowing from downstairs in their cancer department and taking upstairs. And if you go up on my website, GaryNoll.com, and go under photos, you'll see these people doing these experiments back then. I'm so glad I took pictures of them, because who's one of the people you see? Rabbi Abraham Wiseman. And he was a rabbi known for healing hands-on. There was Dr. Dolores Krieger. You'll see her there. And you'll see her holding the little container with a mouse in it, mouse number 37. You'll see Dr. Morton Jacobs and Dr. Thomas Kruth. And in England, there was an absentee healer because the thought was if you can heal someone or something or influence the energy transfer in this moment, then where is it written that energy is limited to distance and time? So I started with the hypothesis that we are all interconnected or conditioning and not living an authentic energy and allowing that authentic energy to vibrate, then disconnects that energy. But there's no stronger energy than a mother when she is vibrating in the same rhythm as the baby. That energy is, especially if there's love and no fear, if there was no desire for abort, if there was no disdain for the child, if there was unconditional love, that is one of the highest vibrations, and that's why mothers are so intuitive. They are all sensitive. And once you understand how sensitive people can be, now there are levels of this, but everyone has intuition. Whether we use it or not is a different matter. So what I found is that after the first experiment, Harry Edwards, who was a famous healer, the most famous healer in English history, he headed the Spiritual Association of Great Britain. And I saw what he did. And I thank goodness I hired a BBC freelance cinematographer to go around with me that week and film everyone. But Dr. Christopher Woodard, Dr. Anne Willie Hart, Dr. Jacobs of the Royal Society, they all claimed to have this gift. None of them could work with the man I brought with me. They didn't know what he had. I didn't tell them. They didn't know which person had this condition. In other words, I wanted to give them no basis for speculation. But I took a person who had had five independent medical examinations, whose condition could not be reversed, and they all signed on that, who had all the x-rays and top test. And so there were a group of about eight of us, because I took a group of scientists with me. And I went for a whole week, and I never will forget, we had one more place to go. And I remember Michael, the guy, the subject, I see him at the elevator with his bag. I said, where are you going? He said, this is all nonsense. This is quackery. This is stupid. I don't know how I allowed myself. My sisters and doctor told me, you know, to try this. I shouldn't have. I don't like any of this. And I'm going home. I said, we only have one more day, just one more person. I said, so why not just wait for tomorrow? Well, it turns out he didn't want to wait for tomorrow, but he missed his flight. So as a result, he came with us, and he was angry and negative. But he was angry and negative in any case. We went up to this beautiful valley, and there was this old manor, I'm guessing a couple, several hundred years old, and it was a rainy day, and we went inside, and we set up the camera, and I asked, where's Harry Edwards? And he's not here right now. So no one was ever told who was the subject. And then I said, look, I don't know where this guy is or where he's going to come in. Just roll the camera. All right? So the camera was rolling. And very quietly, in comes this man, white-haired man, and he comes over behind Michael. Michael's sitting, standing, looking out a window. And as he takes his hand, and I'm 3 feet away, as he takes his hand down Michael's back, but not touching the back, suddenly Michael's whole body begins to wreathe and jerk, and you could hear cracking motions. And it only took 15 seconds. And then he turns and he leaves. And I thought, whoa, it was Michael was then, and Michael had to wear a brace. Michael's condition was that he had been in an accident swimming when he was 16, and he had degeneration of the spine, and he was in a brace, and he couldn't tie his shoes, he couldn't exercise, he couldn't bend over, he was in excruciating pain, he was on pain meds all the time, and his condition was progressively worse, and all the doctors said that it wouldn't get any better. And he'd ultimately be in a wheelchair. And Harry Edwards says, go down and touch your toes. Michael said, I can't do it. He says, yes, you can. So Michael started bending down. Not only did he touch his toes, he did push-ups, sit-ups. You can't imagine all that happened. By the way, he went on to become a really fast runner. In fact, he and I would race together, and he won many races. And I was a top 4, bottom 5-mile runner, and he was right there. And his whole personality changed. His energy changed. But nobody could figure out how he did it. It was only when I was sitting with my editor and I was taking it frame by frame that I came to where he muttered, and I had to get a sound expert to tweak the sound. And here's Harry Edwards saying, I've healed the spirit. Now let the body follow. And I wouldn't have seen that. I wouldn't have heard that had I not picked that out. Because a month after Michael got back, he had the same 5 doctors examine him. They took x-rays. Not a single thing had changed. But something had changed. He was a different person. He could do things he hadn't done. And the doctor says, look, here's the x-rays. Nothing's changed. So he might have had a temporary remission because of placebo effect or wishful thinking. So I said, well, how is it that this guy doesn't know who we're working on, but only goes to Michael and no one else in the room? How is it that he doesn't touch Michael, and Michael's looking out the window, and he takes his hand down behind Michael's back but doesn't touch him, and Michael's body starts doing this wreathing and cracking? Oh, and they try to blow it off as mumbo jumbo. A year later, x-rays show he was totally healed. During that period of time, Michael's personality completely changed. He became a very positive, joyful, happy person. It taught me something. Now, back in the lab, the first round, 6 of the 50 healers were able to actually cause the shrinkage of the tumor mass in the mice. Over the next year, we did it 5 more times. And then I had him doing the energy on sprouts, and suddenly the sprouts they were working on in time-lapse photography grew faster. All these different things we gave him. So what I saw was that indeed energy exists, and indeed absentee energy can work, because Harry Edwards' mice were cured. And all Harry got was a picture of the mice and a number. Each time we sent the pictures with different mice, his were cured. But what was interesting is one of the women in the study, an unusual phenomenon happened. I was generally there at night. And during the daytime, when the people would come in, there would be lab technicians who would monitor them to make sure there was no touching of the actual animal. And every time for almost 2 weeks, lab assistants and technicians and monitors would call in sick. So there was no one there. So I asked the woman, can you come in at 8 o'clock at night? Because I have no one there in the daytime to monitor you. She said, sure. But also importantly, for 4 days in a row, her mice died. So first you think bacterial contamination, viral contamination. You know, it happens. So I'm sitting there, and she starts. She's given the little environment with the cage with the animal. And immediately, I felt this pulsing sensation. I felt an energy field. And I said, hold on a second. I said, what are you thinking? She said, I'm helping the animal. I said, what are you thinking? What thoughts? And she said, I want to stop the animal suffering. So I'm trying to heal it. I said, you're wanting to stop its suffering, but the energy you're giving the animal is actually killing them. And that's why all these lab technicians, when I later talked to them, they all said the same thing. They were fine until she came in, then they got these excruciating headaches, and they couldn't sleep. Now, that taught me another lesson. Now, I've distracted myself for a moment here. Hope this you find this interesting, because I believe it can be applied to other things in life. Some people, even with the best of intents, can put the wrong energy jealousy, the wrong energy. Greed, the wrong energy. Selfishness, the wrong energy. Self-obsession, the wrong energy. Fear of loss, the wrong energy. And as a result, the energy they put into a person, a group, or their work ends up self-defeating it. And that has been something I've studied very carefully. So anyhow, I did all this work, and I did some really unusual studies, studies that are so far out there I won't even talk about them because I don't think many people in this audience would appreciate how powerful energy is. And but at the basis of everything in life is the exchange of energy. And now it's simplified. Exchange negative energy for positive energy. So you eat a good meal instead of a bad meal. You say something kind instead of something hurtful. You respect boundaries. You don't cross boundaries. You write positive things, not negative things. Stop looking at yourself as a victim that justifies your anger. And instead look at yourself as blessed and gifted for the moments you have in life, whatever they may be. Instead of looking at life and yourself as a victim, and therefore surrounding yourself with the story, making up the story, lying in the story, that everything is someone else's responsibility and fault, not yours. Because that energy is a deadly energy, and it creates a toxic reaction and changes the vibration of the energy you put into another person. And energy can be sent anywhere. There is no limit in energy. Anyhow, that's a separate issue. So why do I talk about all this? Because this is from the University of Granada. Quote, and this is published in the peer-reviewed, very prestigious journal, and this was done at the University of Granada Department of Experimental Psychology, the peer-reviewed journal Consciousness and Cognition. Quote, scientific evidence proves why healers see the aura of people. Quote from the study, University of Granada researchers affirm that healers present a neuropsychological phenomena involving a mingling of the senses. The results of this study have been published in the prestigious journal Consciousness and Cognition. The authors remark the significant effect that healers have on ill people. How about that? There's a term that is called synthesis, to talk about a higher prevalence of this phenomena among certain people. And this is what separates out intuition from actual healing. So if you've ever been not to one of these, you know, get in line at a health conference and get one of these people to say, oh, you know, for $5 I'll read your aura, but legitimate people who have a gift and simply share it. Well, for those who discouraged, denigrated, debased, they were wrong. It's now been scientifically proven. How about that? Now, I'm Gary Knoll. We're going to come back in a moment. I'm sure some of you over the internet have been listening to Mike Adams and others talk about how they're really harassing the raw dairy individuals, the milk dairy, the goat's dairy, and the FDA is behind this. The question is, how bad is raw milk that they should be doing this? Well, this is from the Alliance for Natural Health, and I'll quote what they have to say on this. A report from Harvard suggests that milk from factory farms may be associated with hormone-related cancers because of the industrial agricultural practice of milking a cow throughout her pregnancy. Mind you, we're talking about not organic milk now. We're not talking about free-range cattle, but factory farm cattle. The later in pregnancy a cow is, the more hormones appear in her milk. Milk from a cow in the late stage of pregnancy contains 3,300% as much as a signature estrogen compound, like estrone sulfate, as milk from a cow following pregnancy, as well as much higher levels of other hormones. Now, the very healthiest milk would therefore be raw, grass-fed, organic, and from a cow that is only milked for the first 6 months after giving birth, which would include the first 4 months of a new pregnancy. Why can't we get milk that even remotely resembles this ideal? It's because federal regulatory policy, controlled by special interests like the dairy industry, is making our milk even more and shackling consumer choice. Congress is set to introduce the 2012 Farm Bill, which will set the course of federal agriculture and food assistance programs for the next 5 years. It will have a major impact on farmers, consumers, rural communities, and global agribusiness. Now, current federal regulations are designed to encourage farmers to take dairy cows off pasture and put them into the controlled environment of a factory farm. The regulations called the Pasteurized Milk Ordinance are written for statutory systems to increase milk production per cow. This is known as the total confinement dairy model. That is, the huge dairy factory farms would benefit. This practice, however, cuts the productive life expectancy of a cow in half or even more, creates unmanageable diseases, not to mention an environmental disaster, hurts smaller organic dairy farmers. The real solution is to find the most cost-effective model specific to a region's particular environment and balance that with the health of the cow and the best possible milk product. For example, what works in the arid climates of the western U.S. Will not work in the more humid climate of the southeast. The federal government seems to feel that all milk is the same, whereas the nutrient content, such as batter, fat, and protein, varies greatly between different breeds of cow. According to our source, the 2012 Farm Bill may contain provisions to outlaw component pricing of milk, in which a producer is paid for a more high-protein or higher butterfat milk. Component pricing tends to incentivize higher-quality milk and better agriculture practices, and because healthy cows put to pasture, eating green out there will produce more valuable milk than sick cows in stalls or in corrals. Some states have tried to create better policies for milk. California, for example, has higher standards for components of 1 and 2% milk than the government requires. Higher protein content, more calcium, and so forth. Yet the government's trying to stop and shut down California standards. The federal government is also fighting local organic and small dairy producers, mainly because of its close relationship with Big Dairy, the USDA's Dairy and Industry Advisory Lobby. And then there's the pseudo-independent dairy management, which owns the trade names American Dairy Association, National Dairy Council, and U.S. Dairy Export Council. So at the bottom of all this is that there's two ways of looking at it. No one has died by drinking organic certified raw milk. But, and that's in 38 years, but there have been 80 deaths from pasteurized factory farm milk in the same period of time, including 50 people were killed in 1985 alone by cheese from pasteurized milk. So if you want the healthiest milk, if you drink milk, then we should be letting our legislators know no more factory farm dairy. You want organic. And I believe if enough people protested, you could end up getting raw milk back. Right now, you can't. It's against the law. Years ago, I wrote a book on natural pet care. I did a PBS special on natural pet care that aired on PBS stations around the country. It was very popular. In no small reason, because so many pet owners are having sick pets. And I was thinking about this when I was flying out to Denver to premiere my first program on the large PBS station there. I just returned a few weeks before from Italy and in France also. And in both Italy and France, especially in the countryside, I was amazed at how healthy older cats and dogs were. In fact, on one particular farm, there were both cats and dogs. They were lean, they were healthy, they were bouncing around. And I said, how old are they? Expecting the guy to say, oh, 7, 8 years old. 25, 26, 27 years old. You would be hard put to find any dog in the United States alive in their mid-20s. And sometimes cats. I remember it used to be very common where I grew up to have old cats living into their late 20s. Not today. Today, unfortunately, because of the high incidence of immunization, much of which is not necessary, and the processed foods, you're having cats and dogs that are as sick as the humans that care for them. This is from the Ledger. Quote, for many years when I started my career in veterinary medicine as a veterinarian technician, I remember being puzzled as to why we vaccinated cats in so many locations on their bodies. The rabies vaccine was given in one leg, while the feline leukemia vaccine was given in another leg, and other vaccines were given yet another leg. When I was brave enough to ask why we vaccinated cats this way, I was given my first taste of veterinary oncology. Turns out that one out of every 10,000 cats vaccines will cause something called vaccine-associated sarcomas. The notion that a vaccine can cause a type of tumor is scary for cat owners. However, over the past 10 to 20 years, there have been a lot of effort by the veterinary community to decrease this risk. Special risk forces have been developed to determine the best location to vaccinate your cat, how often to vaccinate, and the safest vaccine. You may have noticed that your veterinarian used to vaccinate your cat between the shoulder blades, and now they do it on a leg or a tail. This practice was developed to make it easier to treat a tumor if it occurred. Some vaccines are administered every year, while others can be administered every 3 years to decrease the risk of developing a sarcoma. Vaccines such as feline leukemia virus may only be given to your cat if your veterinarian feels your pet is at risk from catching this virus. Now, here's my thoughts. I believe that most of the vaccines given to dogs and cats have never been proven to be effective, and none of them are safe. I also believe that similar to the food we prepare, the canned food, the bag food, these are very low grade. In fact, a grade that would not be acceptable for human use is then allowed to be used in your pet, as if somehow your pet is immune from food coloring agents, monosodium glutamate, artificial color and dyes. They're not. They're not immune at all. And that's why we have dogs and cats developing a myriad of diseases we never saw in the past at a very high percentages. So my suggestion is, if your cat or dog is sick, you can detoxify them using homeopathic zeolites and using blood purification mechanisms that also work on humans. Read, go to your library and just take out Natural Pet Care and just read it. If you have a dog, a cat, a bird, a horse, a ferret, because all those are covered. Next up, parsley. How many people put parsley on the side of the plate and keep it there when it's been put on your dish in a restaurant? Rarely do we eat parsley. Some people eat a form of parsley called cilantro, mainly in curry dishes. But outside of that, almost never do you have someone ask for parsley. Even in a health food store, parsley is not one of the primary juicing ingredients, but it should be. The British Medical Journal published a medical study to measure the antioxidant capabilities of parsley. A group of people ate a restricted diet for 2 weeks, which was high in parsley, but low in other foods containing flavones, and other natural sources of antioxidants. Then the urinary excretion of the flavone, apigenin, was measured before and during the ingestion of parsley. Apigenin levels were noticeably higher when parsley was added to the diet. The researchers noted that when the subjects were on a restricted diet, their oxidative stress markers rose. However, when people added parsley during the second week of the study, the parsley was able to reverse these numbers somewhat. Now, the Journal of Ethnopharmacology, a major journal, published a study confirming the diuretic effects of parsley, as claimed for years in folk medicine literature. If you want to get rid of swelling from edema in the ankles or in the face, you took parsley. In fact, rats were given parsley seed tea to drink, and over a 24-hour period, the rats had a marked increase in urinary volume. You urinate a lot, and that also helps urinate out a lot of the toxins. And herbalists have been using parsley for the kidneys, joint problems, nerves, and more. I had the pleasure of meeting Dr. John Christopher. I was very young at the time. It was one of the very first major lectures I had ever done. I was fortunate to have a monster best-selling book. It was one of the two biggest selling crossover health books in history. Dell Davis had the other. And I was invited out to Arizona. I was on this long tour. I got to Arizona. I went to my lecture. Turns out I was in the wrong part of the building. And when they finally found me and I went to the right part of the building, the lecture had been going on for about 15 to 20 minutes. But there was two people lecturing. One was Dr. Pablo Arola, and the other was Dr. Christopher, the same John Christopher. And he had this really beautiful, long hair. Kind of reminded me of an older lion. It had a very strong constitution. Pablo Arola, on the other hand, was shorter and had very black hair. And I listened to him for another 10 minutes, and then I went over and did my lecture. And afterwards, they said that they live there in Phoenix, and said, I want to, you know, go out and have something to eat. And I said, sure, because these two people were just legend, and it was wonderful to hear their stories. And Dr. Christopher in particular had hundreds and hundreds of herbs in his place, in jars and hanging and in bags, and he knew what every single one did, because that's what he was a master of. There was no better herbalist in America for 50 years than John Christopher. And I remember him telling me that people don't realize how easy an herb can help them. Well, parsley was one of the things that were made that night. He made us parsley juice. He had apple, which is most of the juice, and then parsley. And I'd never had an apple with parsley juice. And it was very tasty and very strong. And he said, that's good for your kidneys and good for your bladder. And if you ever end up with jaundice, that'll help as well. And he said he helped people with edema using this, and you'd use a parsley root tea if you had stiff fingers, if you couldn't move your joints well. Parsley would help it. Also, it helped with olive oil, and parsley helped with gallstones. And you'd have to drink a pint of fresh parsley tea every day. The herb is also calming to the nerves and adrenal glands. And Dr. Christopher recommended at least 2 quarts of strong parsley tea every day for those issues. And according to Dr. Christopher, fresh parsley juice, probably an ounce, much like wheatgrass juice, is a very potent healer. It can effectively be a blood tonic. It has to be diluted, and I would suggest apple juice as he did. And what I really liked was the conversation we had, because we stayed up virtually all night talking. I didn't know why they wanted to speak with me. I was just becoming known, but I had none of the experience that these people had. And finally, Dr. Christopher turned to me, and he said, when I was about to leave, go to the airport, he said, I now see the future in the health movement in the United States. He said, for a long time, there's just been a handful of people, Carlton Fredericks and Gaylord Houser and Adele Davis. They've controlled the whole movement. And people such as us, meaning Dr. Arola and himself and Bob Hoffman, they have pretty much been excluded because they were purists. They didn't drink, they didn't smoke, they didn't drink coffee. He was vegetarian. And he said, you look at these people. Carlton Fredericks drinks and smokes right on stage for television and promotes a high-protein diet. And he said, these people, they just don't have the ethics or character. And he said, we won't last a whole lot longer in the field because the field is changing. He said, I was amazed at how many young people were there tonight. He said, Dr. Arola said, he said, normally when there's a health lecture anywhere in America, all you see are the white-headed people, like an intellectual Broadway play. He said, it's just the older people holding on to the information given to them by the people they've been around. He said, but there's no one young in the field. He said, it's all yours, no one else. Boy, that made me feel sad. All the way back in the plane, I kept thinking that about this transition, that there was no one young in the field. In every field, you have young people willing to work with the older generation so that there's a transition. And not that you stop if you're older. It's just that where are the younger people going to go? And I found that that was true. That was the only time I ever saw Dr. Christopher. Now, what I was told that he lived to be 104. I don't know if that's true or not. But all I know is when he went to shake my hand, he had a grip that was one of the strongest I've ever had felt in my life. And I'm going to guess at that point he was in his 80s. And Arola, they were both just real gentlemen. But wise beyond measure. And it was Pavel Arola who suggested that if you're going to have people who are going to have blood pressure, what I do, he said, is I give them black tea. I said, why is that? He said, because black tea helps people reduce their risk of heart disease and lowers their blood pressure. And that stuck in my mind because no one I knew drank black tea. Well, here's the latest study from the Journal of the American Medical Association's Archives of Internal Medicine. Quote, black tea may offer blood pressure promise and reduce the risk of heart disease in the general population. How about that? These are a group of scientists from Unilever University in Australia. Our study, quote, has demonstrated for the first time to our knowledge that long-term regular consumption of black tea can result in significant lowering of blood pressure in individuals with normal to high normal range blood pressure. Okay, this is terrific because A, it's inexpensive. B, you can always alter the taste. Black tea tends to be a little tart, but you can put Melaleuca honey in it. You can put some lemongrass in it, lemongrass and Melaleuca honey in with the black tea, and it tastes delicious. So that is good news, but I heard that information at the very beginning of my career from the gentleman who was one of the best natural hygienists in American history, Pavel Arola. For those of you who would like to do Tai Chi, good news for you. If you have Parkinson, it helps you. That's the latest. Tai Chi, a simple exercise. I'm sure you've seen people doing it, very slow motion. It's actually a martial art. It's slow, flowing movement and meditation. It helps improve balance and movement control for people with Parkinson's disease. Now, this is in the New England Journal of Medicine. Quote, in the latest study to show the benefits of Tai Chi for people with chronic health problems, past studies have shown that Tai Chi reduces falls and depression among the elderly and lessens pain for patients with arthritis and fibromyalgia. In Parkinson's disease, nerve cells in the brain that produce the chemical dopamine begin to die. Lower dopamine production can lead to tremors, balance problems, stiff facial expressions, and muffled speech, among other problems. And then it goes on to talk about how Tai Chi and a group of people with Parkinson improved their condition substantially. Well, that's good news. So that's all good. Black tea, terrific for you. Tai Chi, helping as well. And parsley, great if you have edema. Most overweight people have edema. Most people have high sodium in the face. Diet have facial edema. You never notice the bags, puffiness under the eyes and the cheeks? That's a form of edema. So parsley cleanses the blood. So that's just the latest in our area of health and nutrition. And we should be advocating for organic, even though I don't drink dairy,
I believe people should have the right to drink raw milk organically grown. Grasses where cattle can graze on those.
I'm Gary Knoll. We're up to the end of our program. I want to thank you all for taking your time and listening in. I look forward to sharing more on our next program.